through any volitional act of that attorney.
Now, speaking of volitional act, it's a little unclear to me that Attorney Elliott said, this is what I want you to answer, it was his practice that he would go through each piece of paper before he turned that over to opposing counsel. Although, when I read the record here in the briefs, I was unclear whether he had actually looked at those documents that were given from Beth Bauer.
Well, his testimony at the hearing, unfortunately, was not clear. He testified that as he looked at the documents while sitting there testifying at the evidentiary hearing, he did not specifically recall those documents.
Does it make a difference whether he knew that Beth Bauer intended these to be privileged? Does it make any difference? Or is it his assessment whether they should or should not be?
Well, the discovery master found that the documents raised sufficient indicia that attorney would recognize those to be privileged.
Because they were how she thought that things should be presented, as I recall.
Right, and her theories on evidence that supported the claims, and her theories of causes of action, and the like.
Does the record indicate that Mr. Elliott showed any discretion on these privileged documents? Did he withhold any, did he say, in the testimony?
From the materials that were turned over to us, they fell into two categories, documents that related to the underlying transactions, and so clearly were not privileged documents, and then the group that became part of the binder and became exhibits 1 through 10 and we went through 10 and then 14 through 25 were the privileged ones. So we were unable to locate any documents that fell within the context of the attorney-client privilege that were withheld by him.
Can you clarify for us that, and I think I understand this, but I'm not totally clear. You just mentioned that documents were 1 through 25. However, apparently you withdrew any claim of privilege in regard to 11, 12, 13, and 14, is that right?
Yeah, what had happened is when we went through one of the boxes that Mr. Elliott produced for us and we discovered the grouping that raised a concern with us, we presented them together, in the single binder so that the discovery master would have the context of seeing, what we discovered, that in essence, you had some privileged ones and you had some that were not privileged and then you had some privileged ones. And we did it so that the discovery master could see that the context in which we saw them. And then at the hearing, it was clarified that some of those documents in the middle we were not maintaining a privilege about, but they were within the confine of the materials that were privileged. They were mixed in.
In other words, there were 25 documents that came in a row, but of those four, you didn't claim were privileged.
That is correct. That is correct. Now, the Court of Appeals, in reaching its decision, relied on a number of out-of-Wisconsin authorities. Specifically, the Court relied on the Restatement Third of the Law Governing Lawyers, and the Court applied the agency theory stated in the restatement, concluding that counsel has the authority to waive the attorney-client privilege at the time the lawyer is retained because clients routinely delegate those types of responsibilities to their lawyer. The Court of Appeals also concluded that there was no need for the client to knowingly relinquish the right to protect the privileged documents based on a Federal Advisory Committee note to proposed Federal Rule of Evidence 511, and proposed Rule 511 deals with waiver of the attorney-client privilege. In that note, the Federal Advisory Committee commented that with regard to evidentiary privileges, unlike what was at issue in Johnson versus Zerbst, there is not any need for the client to have a knowing relinquishment of that right. However, as we've noted in our brief, that note has not been adopted in Wisconsin.
Counsel, do you know what note is being referred to? Of course, the rules of evidence have evolved. And it wasn't clear to me what Federal Advisory Committee note of what vintage they were referring to.
Well, it is cited in our brief, and I believe it's in 59 West Second. It's toward the back of the volume where the Federal Advisory Committee notes are reprinted. And there is a discussion on proposed Rule 511. And in that discussion on proposed Rule 511, there is a discussion that, unlike Johnson versus Zerbst, which involved waiver of the right to a jury trial.
That's what they relied on. It's a 1938 case. And so I'm not, and of course, as I said, the rules of evidence have evolved, and I'm not sure what Federal Advisory Committee note of what vintage they are relying on. That what existed when Johnson in 1938, there's some reference to the 1950s, or is it when we adopted our code in the mid-1970s? You know, it's changed.
It's what you've just said to the latter, namely when we were revising our federal evidentiary code, which I believe is in 59 West Second, although I can be mistaken. But when we were revising our federal evidence code, what was reprinted for background information was the Federal Advisory Committee notes, and then that note talked about proposed Rule 511 and contrasted the ability to waive the attorney-client privilege versus the ability to waive something like the right to a jury trial, which was discussed in Johnson versus Zerbst.
Thank you.
Now, the Court of Appeals also ignored the long line of cases that have been decided both by the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals stating that the attorney-client privilege belongs to the client and that only the client can waive the privilege. The Court of Appeals sidestepped this authority by concluding that the statements regarding the attorney-client privilege were merely dicta, and therefore those statements were not binding on the Court of Appeals. We believe that the overriding issue presented to this court in this case is whether Wisconsin will deviate from the previously well-established rule that only the client can waive the attorney-client privilege, and whether or not Wisconsin will permit a waiver by counsel when a disclosure is made without the client's knowledge or consent.
Ms. Schlecht,
yes.
Let me ask you, when the Court of Appeals was making its determination, had this court decided the Meeks case?
No, it had not, Your Honor. The Meeks case decision was decided July 10th of 2003, and it actually came down one day after we filed our petition for certification, petition for cert in this case.
So the Court of Appeals decision predates the Meeks decision?
It does.
Do you find the Meeks decision at all helpful in regard to this matter?
I think it's very helpful. One of the distinctions that respondents have made throughout this entire dispute is that the decisions in Dudick, in Swan, in Borgwart, all involve situations in which there was a request made upon counsel to produce information which the counsel maintained was privileged. And before anything got turned over, the matter was brought to the attention of the court and there was a resolution. In all three cases, the resolution was that the materials were privileged, and so counsel was not obligated to turn them over. In contrast, in Meeks, what happened is there was a hearing on the competency of the defendant, and the defendant's former counsel was called as a witness to testify as to that counsel's impressions, thoughts, experiences, having represented that defendant in the past. There had been an objection by the current counsel that information would divulge privileged communications. Nonetheless, that witness testified, an appeal was taken, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court held that disclosure was an unauthorized disclosure of a privileged communication. The case was then remanded back down for a new hearing on the competency, and there was a specific directive that testimony of that kin, namely the former counsel's impressions of that client as it impacted competency, could not be considered. And that's important because what we're asking here is for a reversal of the Court of Appeals decision and affirmance of what the trial court said, namely that the materials are privileged, that the privilege was not waived, and that respondents are not permitted to use them. And that's what happened in Meeks. Once it was remanded down there, back down to the court, there was a specific directive that kind of testimony could not be taken into account when the court had the new competency hearing and made the decision on competency. So I think that's a very important decision.
Could I ask to follow up that? how do you block out all of the knowledge that has been gained by the other side? Certainly you might say you can't use this document, but how can you block out the substance of that document and all the proceedings?
There's no question that once there's been a disclosure of a privileged communication, there is a challenge to remedying that situation. However, courts have had to address that situation not only in the context of an attorney-client disclosure, but they've addressed it in the context of other cases. And one example is in the area of trade secret litigation between an employer and a former employee. There's a situation where the employee learns through his or her employment various trade secrets of that employer. That employee then leaves to take another job. Wisconsin law favors the mobility of employees, but Wisconsin also has adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And those two principles obviously collide once that employee leaves and goes to another employer who, in all likelihood, is a competitor. Well, courts have fashioned rules and remedies under the Uniform Trade Secret Act to prevent those former employees from using the trade secrets. There are injunctions that are entered that preclude them from using the information. There can be selective restrictions as to the kinds of specific job responsibilities they can do, the specific tasks they can be involved in, where it is likely that they might use or divulge the trade secrets. The line of the PepsiCo cases involving trade secrets is a classic example of how courts have tried to fashion remedies, acknowledging you can't erase what somebody's in their brain, but you can impose limitations and hope that their integrity and responsibility will then enhance the ability for that remedy to be effective.
Counsel, as I looked at a couple of days ago, the Court of Appeals opinion, in part, it seemed to rest on the special relationship between the attorney and client, and part of that relationship is delegation that they relied on in the Court of Appeals. And then concluded that if the attorney releases it, then it's waived. What ramifications, if any, are there for the other special relationships which also constitute privilege under our statute, that is, physician-patient, clergy, member of whatever, clergy-person, husband-wife? Those are all special relationships. Does the logical extension of the Court of Appeals opinion suggest that the physician or the clergy person, if voluntarily disclosed, constitutes waiver, or am I wrong?
Your Honor, that is how the Court of Appeals decision in this case is being applied. In the State versus Demi case, which I believe came down in February of 2004, that involved a counselor-patient relationship. It had dealt with an abuse case, and there was an issue as to whether or not there was an unauthorized disclosure by that counselor of what that patient had disclosed. Citing to this Court of Appeals case in this decision, it's a District 2 case, the court held that based on this decision, any volitional act, whether intentional or inadvertent, results in the waiver of that privilege. And if you give me one moment, I can give you the citation. State versus Dennis, it is 2004 Westlaw 201-264. It's a February 4th, 2004 decision.
Published?
Pardon me?
Published?
It says publication page references are not available for this document. Now, petitioners assert that this court should adhere to the longstanding rule that's in Wisconsin that only the client can waive the privilege, and that in cases where a lawyer produces a privileged document without the knowledge or consent of that lawyer's client, there should not be a waiver. This rule obviously weighs heavily against waiver, but we believe that it promotes the purposes of the attorney-client privilege, which is to encourage confidence and trust between the client and the lawyer, and it also promotes professionalism.
That may be, but the argument on the other side is that the client has to be held to what the lawyer does. That we had a case that the lawyer was sanctioned. There was a sanction in the case, and I can't remember if it was discovery or some other issue or delay, and there was a severe penalty. I think one case was a dismissal. Another may have been financial penalty. And the client was not at fault at all in those cases. But the court said, look, you hired this lawyer. The lawyer is your agent. You are held responsible, along with the lawyer, for anything that the lawyer does. And why is that any different from here? Because otherwise, what you have is no one can take the lawyer's word for anything in a case. You always have to have the client sign off. And the whole theory about the negotiation, the whole theory about lawyers dealing with each other is that there's authority. And if there isn't, you get the lawyer for malpractice or for discipline.
In those, the two cases that are cited by respondents are the Johnson case and the Duginsky case. The Johnson relates to noncompliance of discovery orders. The Duginsky deals with a lawyer having moved, misplaced a complaint, not timely answered, and the issue of the default. I believe that those cases are different because those cases, by the nature of the issues that are before them, apply a discretionary standard. The court looks at the facts and circumstances and determines whether or not the client is going to be held responsible for the acts of the lawyers. And Chief Justice Abramson, you dissented in the Johnson case, and in that case you noted that, in fact, the plaintiffs in that case who suffered the effect of having their case dismissed because of the lawyer's conduct, in fact, knew 4 months in advance of the imposition of that sanction, and yet they chose to do nothing. They didn't do anything. They didn't write to the court. They didn't tell the court, we didn't know this is going on. We'll get a new lawyer. We'll try to rectify the situation. Nothing was done. In the Duginsky case, what was at issue was a contested divorce, and there had been a series of proceedings, and I believe it was one spouse was trying to enforce a judgment against the other one, and the one who was complaining of the attorney's acts had failed to appear for a court appearance, had the sheriff come out, arrest them, come in for a court appearance. There was a lot of conduct in there which gives the court discretion in those sorts of situations to come to this conclusion. What we're saying in this case is that the attorney-client privilege is obviously a very important element of the legal system, and we're asking that there be a bright-line test, not the bright-line test that the Court of Appeals advocated, which was waiver. We're asking for a bright-line test that says if the information is disclosed without the knowledge or consent of the client, there is no waiver. And so there's a difference in the analysis of those cases.
In your bright line rule, I have one concern. In this case, I don't suppose it could be argued there was reliance to the detriment of the other side on the information they got, but that might not always be the case. So if we had a bright line rule and the attorney disclosed something that was privileged, the other side relied on it in circumstances where reliance was justified, wouldn't we have problems with the bright-line rule you propose?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. We cited to a number of cases in our reply brief. They are non-Wisconsin authorities, but they talk about the issue of reliance. And in those decisions, the courts discuss the fact that opposing counsel has no right to the privileged communications of the other side to begin with. And so they have no justifiable reliance there. They had no expectation of getting...
How would they know it? How would they know? I mean, lawyers deal with one another on things on a daily basis, and you don't always ask the other lawyer, well, did your client say it was okay to give me this or to represent this or that? How would they know?
Well, certainly in this case, if
this
you look
case,
at...
This case, I think, is a little bit different, but I was really going after your bright line rule is more what I was looking at when I was trying to figure out you know, where the line should be drawn and what we should come up with. And that's my concern.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of times the kinds of documents that are turned over do raise an indicia of attorney-client privilege. Mm-hmm. You know, a letter intended to go to the client might be faxed to opposing counsel by mistake because the secretary inputs the wrong fax number into the machine. You know, you get a production of documents, and you're sort of puzzled by these particular ones, and so you call up the other lawyer. I mean, one would hope that In the instance of this rule, it would also foster more professionalism, where lawyers realize that if the rule is that the privilege is not going to be waived, they're not going to be able to use the document, and so they're going to hopefully work with opposing counsel in saying, did you really mean to turn this over?
Well, the problem with the bright-line rule, I think, is the question of what communication, if any, there was between the client and the lawyer, because if you have to guess what's privileged, and here, you know, I mean, that perhaps it's clearer because these were, let's say, theory of what we're going to do in this case individually. But most of the time, you might not have that. And so the lawyer, one lawyer may say, I think this is privileged, as perhaps happened in this case, and the other might say it's not. And then in these documents, 1 to 25, it was decided that certain numbers, two or three of those, were not privileged. So it's a very difficult thing to have a bright line unless you have exactly what the communication is. And how do you address that? How do you decide exactly what that, where the privilege is, or what the document is privileged?
Well, again,
a bright line is fine, except we have to know where to draw the line.
That's correct. As I indicated, and I'm drawing on not only from this case, but my experience, is generally when you have a document production, you receive documents and that are obvious correspondence or documents relating to a transaction or things like that. Then there always are the handwritten notes, things, the fax cover sheets, things that will raise the issue. And when you read a document where somebody is, you know, writing to their lawyer on a handwritten piece of paper, or, you read a document that looks like they're discussing the theory of the case, I mean, generally lawyers are smart enough that that lights go on in their head to say, you know, gee, what is this document?
Well, we don't always deal with that light going on. That's what I'm saying. Generally, if there is no discussion, if you simply turn over a box of documents and then the lawyer goes ahead and makes his or her decision, and I think this case is a little different because of the content of the document, but to have a bright line, you have to have some starting rules, and I'm just saying, what would you do in that case? How do you bring it to the lawyer's attention? Just by giving him documents and letting him decide, and then later on saying, no, that was privileged, that wouldn't work.
Well, obviously there's no perfect solution, you know, to every situation. I think that's why it is the expectation that if you apply such a rule, there's more cooperation between counsel. And if there's questions about a document, it's raised. I mean, oftentimes, if it's not obvious on the face of the document, the issues come up when you take the first deposition and you pull the document out, and then the lawyer looks at it and says, oh, my gee, I didn't mean to turn that over. And my experience is that when that has happened, you know, I have given it back, or, you know, if I've been on the other end of it, it's been given back to me. And again,
it's not too late at that point. It's not, once it's turned over, it's not too late.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I believe the issue is you can't use them.
Thank you, Ms. Schlicht. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Oh, okay.
25 minutes pass quickly.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Right.
Attorney Scott R. Halloyne, representing the Linda Gale Sampson 1979 Trust et al. Counsel?
That's correct. Thank you.
You've got 30 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd actually like to focus in on the questions that Justice Wilcox asked both at the beginning of the presentation and the end, because I really do think that there are some interesting facts that are unique to this case that exemplify why a clear, bright-line rule is inappropriate. And the reason why it is inappropriate is no matter how clearly you define that bright line, there's always going to be extreme examples that come on that make that bright line very difficult to apply later. And there's some, and they really are things that are unique to this documents. What you need to remember is that the documents at issue in this case are documents that were prepared in connection to a prior arbitration and discovery documents relating to a prior dispute relating to the same transaction. They are also documents that were included as part of a production of all of the documents that were discovery documents relating to that prior arbitration proceeding. And with respect to that prior arbitration proceeding, it's also important to remember that the document production as a whole, which is vast, it's about maybe 9 inches, were replete with handwritten notes by Ms. Bauer. In fact, before Theodore Hodan, Ms. Bauer even admitted that Attorney Kravitz, her former counsel, specifically admonished her for writing over the original documents with her handwritten comments. And they made an election in that prior arbitration proceeding to produce the documents with her handwritten comments. It's also important to remember that out of those exhibits 1 through 25 that we are talking about, 3 of the exhibits were your traditional attorney-client communication letters. And those were withdrawn. And they're withdrawn for 2 reasons. And they're very important reasons to remember in the context of this, because, it goes to the bright line rule issue. They were withdrawn, 1, because those clear attorney-client communications, as it may appear to somebody who is a dispassionate third person, were in fact already produced by the Kravitz firm in the earlier litigation. And 2, this is a case where the very nature of the lawsuit creates some unusual aspects with respect to the attorney-client privilege, because one of the claims against Attorney Nancy Simos has been defended with the concept of Ms. Simos saying, I was never retained by the parties that are suing me. I was actually representing the other side. There has also been an allegation in this case that was briefed simultaneously before the discovery master dealing the issue of whether or not a trustee that is also an attorney was actually representing the petitioners in this case. And that attorney testified, no, in fact, he was not. He was representing the other side. So we have a very unusual situation where we have, within the confines of this lawsuit, 2 attorneys who are being accused by the petitioners of being their attorney, who are saying that they were actually representing the other side, and for which there is no evidence of a retainer letter. So you've got a very extreme example here, and it must be remembered in the context of this case, that's what Discovery Master Hodan was trying to deal with. The fact that you've got the issue of who is the attorney, who is the attorney representing, a prior mediation proceeding where discovery materials were produced and for which there was a whole-scale, very widely spread waiver of the attorney-client privilege with respect to those communications.
Mr. Halloween, when the referee, Mr. Hodan, was looking at this, didn't he come to the conclusion that all the documents at issue were privileged?
He concluded based upon the testimony of Ms. Bauer. Ms. Bauer provided the testimony that she had prepared those documents at the request of her first attorney, even prior to the start of the arbitration, who had requested that she write down her remembrance of the facts. It's a 1995 transaction, and he encouraged her to write down essentially everything you know about it. That's also important as it relates to the documents at issue here, because these are not your traditional opinion letters from clients, letters between the attorney and the client. These are somebody's notes. These are somebody's belief of what the facts were as it relates to the transaction. In fact, that's part of the reason why these documents are so significant and why this case is before the Supreme Court, because the contention has always been of the Sampson investment parties that those documents are entirely consistent with the presentation of their claim in the mediation or the arbitration below and in this case. And those documents reflect that Ms. Bauer knew precisely who was her attorney at the time, who was representing her, and who was not.
Counsel?
The answer is that he did find all of the documents were privileged?
He did find all the documents were privileged, yes.
And that was based on Ms. Bauer's testimony?
Ms. Bauer's explanation as to why they were prepared, yes.
Did she indicate that she in any way had waived that privilege or given counsel authority to waive the privilege?
She testified that she did not intend to waive the privilege. The testimony below was that the box of documents were picked up at the Kravitz firm by Ms. Bauer and delivered to Attorney Elliott. And although Ms. Schlicht has attempted in her oral argument to create this to be an inadvertent situation, it wasn't. There was, on cross-examination, a detailed document-by-document examination by me of Attorney Elliott, who indicated that he believes that he followed his standard practice of going through every single document. In fact, during the examination, I put every document before him and asked him the same series of questions, that he reviewed each document, and to the extent that he believed that there were any issues with respect to privilege, his standard practice was to go back to the client and ask questions about it. And that's what the discovery master found happened here.
Am I correct that Mr. Elliott, however, did not specifically recognize these documents?
He testified with respect to the entire production that some time had passed, and he did not have a specific recollection of any of the documents in the production. But he did not dispute that he had received those documents.
Did he say that if he, when he was looking at them in the hearing before the master, that he then believed they were privileged?
Well, there's a dispute on how you interpret his testimony. He gave a response that was non-responsive. He indicated that he did not intend to waive the attorney-client privilege, mm-hmm. but that he intended to produce the documents at the time and that he did not believe the documents were privileged. In fact, that he maintained that steadfastly with respect to all of the documents.
At that time, but yes. I guess my question goes to what was his thought at the time that you examined him when the documents were before him?
He still believes the documents were not privileged, but testified that he did not intend to waive the privilege if they were.
Okay, so he testified that at the even after the fact, he believed they were not privileged.
Yes.
Thank you.
May I elaborate just for one moment? I apologize. You have to remember that these documents were produced at the same time as responses to interrogatories. Mm-hmm. And these summaries, these fact summaries that are provided are directly responsive to the interrogatories that were also served. And I think a very logical interpretation of this is that those are the answers to the interrogatories. That's what they do. They don't lay out, because they're, again, these are, for the most part, pre-retention of the Kravitz firm, which even brought the arbitration. These lay out her chronology of what the facts were at the time of the transaction and are directly responsive to interrogatories regarding state the factual basis of what happened at the closing that's at issue in this lawsuit. I'm sorry.
Sure. I just need to nail this down, and I thought that Justice Crooks nailed it down, and now the nail seems to be popping up again. From the earlier comments that you made, it suggested to me that we were still in the inquiry as to whether or not some of these documents were really confidential and talking about the different kinds of documents. And Justice Crooks asked you about that, and you responded, and then Justice Crooks followed it up essentially with a yes or no question. And you, as I understood it, agreed that the finding of the referee was that these, and it's on page 6 of his report, that I find that these exhibits constitute confidential communication made by a client or an attorney in order to facilitate the performance of professional legal services to the client.
Yes.
So, it's my sense that the issue as to whether or not these are confidential is behind us, but perhaps I'm incorrect. Are you asserting that we should not accept the referee's finding with regard to those materials?
Your recitation of what the referee's finding is correct. That's what he found. And given Ms. Bauer's testimony that that's, assuming that it is true, that that's why she produced the documents, That would be consistent with the finding. But that does not mean that it's behind us, because I think endemic in that type of testimony from Ms. Bauer lays the problem with this so-called lenient rule that was advanced by Ms. Schlicht, and it is addressed in one of the cases that was addressed at length in the appellate court, which is that if you adopt that type of lenient rule, you are always going to be at risk of this springing type of problem in a case where a document that does not appear to be privileged on its face, and I can tell I'm going beyond the scope of your question, so perhaps I'll...
No, in fact, you're leading me to my next question, okay. And that is, I'm always concerned that the sky is falling, arguments regarding the sky is falling, because, you know, it's always up there after I hear those arguments, even. And with regard to what I interpret your argument to be, and maybe I'm not correct, but I kind of hear your argument counseled to be the sky is falling if we adopt that kind of bright-line rule. Maybe I'm pushing it. Maybe you're just saying it's a bad idea to adopt that bright-line rule. But I've taken a look at what is it, ALR 5th article, 1997. And, you know, it, as they often do, gives a compilation of all the states and what they've done. And in, at least on page 63 of my copy, it sets out in this bright line area, you know, it has, as you say, the strict, and then it's the lenient, and then it gets to this middle totality of circumstances balance. And it says, under no imputed inadvertence, the bright line rule, I'm adding that language. The text doesn't say that right there. It says, so where the release has been by someone other than the privilege holder, the following authorities support an argument that the releaser's inadvertence should not be imputed to the privilege holder. And then it goes on to cite 25 different states, including Wisconsin, as that's our law. And in discussing Wisconsin, it cites Dudek's piece in the Borgwart versus Redland case. Now, I haven't read all of this stuff. I'm just reading the compendium of cases and the analysis in this ALR 5th. But... I mean, 25 states have embraced that rule, and at least the authors of this ALR article think that we've embraced this rule. So why is it so bad, and it's going to be an awful rule in the future?
Sure. First of all, I'd like to address that specific page and point out that I am painfully aware of that as of 4 o'clock in the morning this Sunday, because I actually went back and checked those cases. And I can tell you that, unfortunately, the author of that did not do a very careful job, because most of the cases that are cited in that footnote do not actually support the proposition, any more than I would contend that Dudek actually goes to that extent. I also think that it is important here to recognize that, at least from other authorities that have been...
Maybe I misunderstand. Yeah, what I'm referring to is not a footnote. It's part of the...
There's a text, a portion of it where it indicates, I recall, the 25 states, and it gives citations. And perhaps I'm talking about a different...
Must be talking about something else.
Okay. But there's also an ABA treatise that is on point that deals with this. There's also an Alaskan Law Review article that I believe was cited in one of the papers by Ms. Schlicht. And actually, fundamentally, those citations have been unreliable. I've seen citations with respect to what the majority rule and minority rule is for inadvertence. I do believe the correct count is that the majority rule, by about half, is the balancing test, that the strict approach and the lenient approach are roughly equal, and then there's a number of states that simply have not addressed the issue.
Let me just ask you about that. Many of the inadvertence cases deal with the document is marked by the lawyer as privileged, recognized by the lawyer as privileged. The lawyer or staff then make a mistake. And instead of putting them aside, these marked copies, send them out
Mm-hmm.
And that's the usual inadvertent case, that it's inadvertently mailed or inadvertently faxed or inadvertently delivered. Never intended to deliver it. Recognized the privilege, didn't want to deliver, goof, delivery. In this case, I would assume you'd argue, lawyer went through the materials. Practice was to mark things that and not deliver privileged documents. Decided nothing was privileged. Intentionally mailed all documents. Intentionally believing them to be not privileged. And that therefore this is not an inadvertent case. And that the inadvertent cases should be set aside and you should apply a different rule here. Have I gone too far?
No, absolutely not. In fact, if I could, in a nutshell, break it down, because I think you've hit the pulse of the case. The foray into the inadvertent rules is interesting and does provide scholarly context, no doubt. But the fact here is that intent does matter, and intent matters from a practical reason and also from a statutory reason. First, let's deal with the statutory. I do believe, and in the Lane case, this court actually addressed it in dealing with the concept of the privilege, and talking about the fact that on page 90 of that case, the court indicated that the privilege belongs to the client or the lawyer, if it's been delegated to it. And then it also indicates, furthermore, because the lawyer-client privilege is an obstacle to the investigation of truth, it should be strictly confined within the narrowest possible limits consistent with the logic of the principle. We're dealing with a privilege, and we're dealing with a balancing test of the search for the truth and restrictions imposed by the privilege versus the desire to have the privilege and its benefits. I believe that that balancing is actually within the statutes, and that is what the appellate court was driving at. If you look at 905.032, there is the language specifically at the end of that section which indicates that the lawyer has the authority to do assert the privilege and that authority is presumed. That language is very important because the statutory scheme specifically acknowledges the fact that there is, in many circumstances, a delegation to the lawyer to actually determine whether or not that's privileged. And that makes sense in the real-world context because the client, you generally, is not in a situation to understand what the privileges rules are, and they are giving that delegation to the attorney to rely upon their expertise to determine whether or not a document is privileged and to raise the appropriate questions. In the waiver rule, in 905.11, it's very important to note that the waiver rule specifically deals with the fact that a waiver deals with a voluntary disclosure. So we're dealing with two separate concepts working within these statutes. The client can delegate the decision-making process to the attorney, and then the attorney can voluntarily disclose that information based upon their own independent justice.
Counselor, let me ask you this question. Just say I agree with you. And so I say, well, you know, the attorney disclosed this information, and what I give you as opposing counsel is part of a transaction. And you can tell that it's part of a transaction. You say, aha, you know, you waived that. It may have been privileged, but you waived it by disclosing. How far does the waiver go? You know, if you waive some privileges as to a transaction, you have to waive them all the way through. You look at a person's testimony who waives Fifth Amendment rights, can't pop them on and off whenever you kind of feel like doing it. What do we do if we adopt your rule? How far does the waiver go?
That's an interesting question. I think that with respect to the appellate court's decision, at least the way the issue is framed, in fact, specifically on the issue for appeal, that the appellate court made it clear that it is dealing with the discovery rules as it relates to this, and we are not jumping to the next step of the evidentiary rules. And in civil litigation, that's the down-the-road issue. Although, obviously, we would be thrilled to have this court address the issue of what's down the road. The fact of the matter is the appellate court did not do that and limited it to the discovery rule context, and I believe that this court can as well.
But what we do here will have an impact down the road because, though you may be happy, I can assure you the next litigant that has this issue will want to take it a step further.
Sure. And if I may, the policy that this court is defining really does come down to a nutshell between the difference between intentional and inadvertence and who bears the risk of loss. To the extent that you've got an issue where a lawyer just clearly makes an error of judgment, I think it's appropriate for this court to set as a policy the implication on the lawyer. Look, lawyers, we want you to go through these documents carefully, to raise issues with your clients, to check with them, and make sure your document production is correct. With respect to inadvertence, I think it's perfectly reasonable for this court, and obviously many courts from other jurisdictions have done so, to impose a different standard. Some courts have decided that in inadvertence that you want to have a more forgiving standard and basically say, no harm, no foul, return the documents. I think that other courts have decided to have a strict rule. And I would actually suggest that, although that's a very interesting discussion, that's a really fact-specific discussion that deals with the time and length of the disclosure, the nature of the documents, whether it's obvious, and the due diligence that was done by the attorney. But when you're dealing with intentional, it's really easy for this court to define what the error is. And here, the error is a mistake of judgment by the attorney. And I think it would be poor public policy by this court to impose a standard that relieves the attorney from that obligation of diligently going through the documents and instead thinking, I've got these documents from the client, I don't have time to look at them, I'll ship them off, and if there's something in there I have to worry about, at least I know I can get them back.
Counsel, oftentimes an argument and an opinion that we write is, and the result of the case, is governed by how you frame the question or the issue. You are making, and as a, I think in response to the Chief's question, this distinction between voluntary and inadvertence. And yet, you can say, I think, based on this record, rather clearly, that the attorney voluntarily turned over the documents. The record is absolute on that. I think that you can say equally with certainty that the attorney did not voluntarily or knowingly, and let me insert that, turn over privileged documents, and he testified that if he had known they were privileged, he wouldn't have turned them over, and that's in the referee's findings and conclusions. So isn't it just how you frame the question in part? Did he knowingly and voluntarily turn over the document? Absolutely yes. Did he knowingly and voluntarily turn over privileged information? Absolutely not.
Well, that's a very interesting question. And just to put it into real-world terms, I happen to have a 2-year-old. And I think the difference between intent and inadvertence can be based upon what she does in every meal. Some meals, she knocks a dish off the table by mistake, and it usually will hit one of our dogs in the head. Sometimes, she will take that plate, and she will throw it at the dog. Now, it all depends upon where you put the harm, the fault, there. If she knocks it off by mistake, you pick it up, you make sure that she's okay, but you don't reprimand her. If she throws it at the dog, you reprimand her. In the situation that we're dealing here, you're dealing with a situation where an attorney admits that he went on a document-by-document privilege review and made the determination that the documents were not privileged. And these were documents that were not obvious on their face.
What Judge Hodan
was saying, though, and excuse me, was that he believed that an inquiry should have been made. That's what he says in his opinion, that what Attorney Elliott's error wasn't that he didn't know the documents were privileged. It was that he didn't pick up the phone and say, what the heck is all of this? And to that extent, that's where the risk of loss, the fault, should be. And you have to remember that when an attorney makes a mistake in this context, as Attorney Elliott did here, both sides are harmed, and I think this litigation proves that in a large degree. I think that the plaintiffs are correct in saying we lost something here. But you have to remember that the defendants have spent quite a bit of money and resources and built their case and filed summary judgment based upon the assumption that those documents were not privileged. And if they were to lose that, to lose access to those documents, they are losing something too here. So what you're really doing is balancing, okay, if there has been a mistake, where are we going to put the risk of loss? If there's an intentional error, where do we put the risk of loss?
Counselor, in discovery, I think you said earlier that these documents that there's an objection to are really responsive to your interrogatories, which doesn't surprise me. Yes. They often go hand in hand. So if, in fact, they are, and if you don't get to use the documents, you can just ask the information in a deposition of someone and ask them questions, can't you? I mean, you can't – well, just let me finish. You cannot obviously prep for the deposition if the other side wins using the documents, but certainly you know where the hot points are in the litigation between the two of you, and I would imagine if you could frame interrogatories that went to what you say is in the documents, you could frame questions without the use of the documents for a deposition. I can't see how there's a lot of difference.
In the ordinary circumstance, you would hope that would be the case. And therein lies the rub here, because we do have the benefit of a prior arbitration proceeding. And we do know the presentation of the facts as it relates to what happened during this transaction is remarkably different from what Ms. Bauer's notes that are closer to the transaction reflected to be. Therein lies the value of the documents and why this issue is being so hardly fought on this appeal.
Right, but I think your response was you said that the documents are really responsive to the interrogatories, so just put the interrogatories in the form of a deposition and ask the questions and get her on the stand, I mean, under oath.
And my point is, we've done that already. All the witnesses here were deposed in the prior arbitration proceeding, and the version of the facts that came out is different than the version that's reflected. And I anticipate that if we were to put them on the stand again, because although this lawsuit is broader, the transaction is the same, that we are going to once again get a different version than the version that is reflected in these notes. And the version, oh, I apologize.
We use these notes to impeach the witness.
Yes.
That's your point.
Yes.
I thought you said this is a discovery case, not an evidentiary. And now you tell us it's being used in the summary judgment.
So I apologize, I didn't hear.
I said, you, in response to a question of Justice Rogensack, you said this is a discovery case, not an evidentiary case. Yet your summary judgment depends on using these documents for support of the summary judgment. So it is used as evidence.
Yes, we have attempted to.
And if you should lose here, you'd have the fruits of the poisonous tree issue, wouldn't you?
You mean the fact, well, or the bell is unringing issue? Yes.
Right. I just put it into the terminology generally used in criminal cases. I'm not suggesting this is a criminal case. But if you want to use something that you're not allowed to have seen, then at least in some cases the issue is inevitable discovery. Would you have discovered this otherwise, or led to it otherwise, but if it's related closely being the kick a word, you can't use it. So that would be the next problem here, if you should lose.
Yes.
Is the issue of whether a document is privileged a question of fact or law?
That's a good question. The characterization of what the document is an issue of fact, but I believe the determination of whether the privilege exists is an issue of law. And going back, and
if no one was bound by the referee's legal conclusion.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understood your question, and I want to make sure that I'm answering it correctly. If you're asking me if the next issue, if the decision is made that these documents must be returned,
right.
The next issue is what do you do to the extent that there have been disclosures made, and how do you unring the bell? I can tell you that the motion that is an issue in this case has been three times requested for a disqualification of the Mallory and Zimmerman firm as a result of the receipt of this. And so you are correct that to the extent that there is an issue of whether how do you unring it, that that's already been attempted unsuccessfully now three times. And therein lies the rub. When you have a documents that are produced mistakenly, erroneously, and then they sit out there for so long, and they are used, and they're put in summary judgment, they're used in the strategy of the case, in this case, analyzed in connection with a very lengthy set of discovery materials from an earlier arbitration proceeding, the fact of the matter is the unringing of that bell is very difficult to do. And therein lies the harm to the party that receives the documents as a result of this error, where the documents are not obviously privileged. and are thought to be legitimate documents that you could utilize, it's very difficult to unring that bell. In fact, I think impossible in most instances that are like this.
Except I assume that the, should you lose, and I, that it would be that you return the documents and that you would be enjoined from using them or using information derived therefrom. I mean, I think that's what the request would be, right?
And we have already addressed that issue to minor degrees again here. And when the documents are facts, they're summary of facts, and they're summary of facts of a detailed conversation, you are going to be replete with disputes as to whether or not the origin of the knowledge of those facts came from the allegedly privileged documents or not. It's impossible to sort out when it's facts. It's different if it's opinions. You know, if there's a lawyer from a letter expressing an opinion, it's easier to trace it back. But when it's just facts garnered over a 7-year history of litigation, it is very difficult to do that.
Now, it was about 3 months before the demand was made, if I remember it, for your record,
for the
records. In that interim, and I don't know if it's in the record, I see that there's a record here and that there's a separate box of records, was revelation made to your clients?
Excuse me?
What did you reveal to your clients what the discovery showed?
Were the documents shown to the clients? Oh, repeatedly. They were produced. A lot of them are accounting records, mm-hmm. and they were, the day they were produced, went through with the client for almost an entire day and part of the next day for purposes of preparing depositions that were to happen the day after that. And because, my wife would say I'm not very good at math, period, but obviously we would want to get the benefit of an accountant who is one of the defendants in this case, and also because one of the defendants is a lawyer, to get their benefit as well. So they went through the documents in detail.
Chief, may I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm going to take you back to your child throwing food at the dog. And when I heard that, I thought, okay, you know, sometimes the child intentionally throws at the dog, sometimes the child inadvertently knocks off the plate, the dog. But I sat thinking, but as a parent, you know, half the time I don't know what the child did because I only see the plate coming down, and which gets me to my point of why, and I need your help in response to this, please. You know, why worry about, is it inadvertent or is it intentional? Or should I skew the question at the outset and say it was not intentional to release privileged information? Why fool around with all of that? Why just not say that with regard to an attorney's release, as opposed to the client's release, which, you know, inadvertent and intentional might come into play, but with regard to an attorney's release, just say, hey, look, the attorney doesn't hold the privilege. Our law has consistently been the client holds it, the client can waive it. Why am I wrong in taking that simple approach?
Sure, and I think we're coming back to the initial discussion we had at the beginning of this. First, to put real-world terms on it, my daughter is Chelsea and the dog is Daisy. And the general response that I get from my daughter is, Daisy did it. So when you're talking about the actual example, I understand completely what you're talking about. Fortunately, litigation is a little bit different in that you usually do know where the error lies. And in this instance, Attorney Elliott said he reviewed the documents and said there was a clear error. I guess the question, though, does come as to whether or not it makes sense to have a bright-line rule or not. And if you have the bright-line rule that you are referring to in that analogy, you're dealing with a bright-line that says the client, if they assert the privilege, always has a right to give that back. And as a commercial litigation practitioner, I can tell you that the discussion that is in some of the cases with respect to the problem with that rule is very true. You're always going to be at risk for documents of the nature of this, where it's notes. Say it's that handwritten note that's on a notepad or sticky note that's attached to a document that's the smoking gun of the case. Of the client saying on the eve of trial, you produce that? I intended that to be privileged. And then it disrupts both sides' presentation of the case and mightily disrupts the presentation of the case of the receiving party. I believe that there's a bright-line rule that is going to minimize disputes. The best thing this court can do is to encourage lawyers to diligently review documents and make sure those mistakes do not occur, and not allow a circumstance, basically allowing the people who are receiving the documents to know after a point in time that if they've received those documents, they can use those, incorporate those that into their defense. Our frustration with this case is that the document we used these documents. We put them in a summary judgment motion. We included and discussed them in an affidavit, and that motion was responded to specifically by Ms. Bauer, the creator of this document, without saying, hey, that document's privileged. It shouldn't be returned. We then submitted a reply brief and again attached it. And if you look at the affidavits, we didn't attach a lot of documents to that summary judgment motion. This was one of a handful. We again attached it. Ms. Bauer still says nothing about it, and it's not until a month after that fact, when it is looking problematic, that all of a sudden that document becomes a privileged communication. And that's the problem with having a bright-line rule where the client can always withdraw the document, because it creates chaos over a lengthy litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Schlicht, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
First, I'd like to just go through a few clarifications of the record, and the citations supporting what I'm going to say already in our opening brief. Ms. Bauer testified as to the timing of the creation of the documents, and contrary to what Respondents' Counsel said, they were not all created prior to the arbitration. Exhibits 1 through 10 were created for Attorney Wiseman, who she had consulted with prior to the time that she retained Attorney Kravitz to handle the arbitration. Exhibits 14 through 25 were created after the arbitration when they were looking for new counsel to handle the larger dispute that were between the parties. So it's incorrect to say, based on Ms. Bauer's testimony, that in fact the documents were all created prior to the arbitration. Second of all, with regard to the summary judgment, respondents have made an issue out of the fact that privileged documents were part of the submission. In fact, it was one single document. It is Exhibit 1 in the binder, which I assume the court has access to, but Exhibit 1 to the binder is a list of initials. It's the index to all of the other documents that Ms. Bauer prepared, and it's just as if my name was on here, it would be JCS, Jane C. Schlicht. In this case, it was BB, Beth Bauer, AM, Ann Mandelman. So when we were looking at the document, that's nothing that struck us as privilege because it was a single page in an entire context of materials we had not yet reviewed. So I want the court to be clear that the only document that is part of the privileged materials that was submitted in the summary judgment brief was that single page listing names of people involved in these disputes and their initials that would be used throughout the documents. Second of all, or third of all, with regard to the breakdown of the three rules, prior to filing petitioner's brief, I did extensive research on Westlaw as to exactly what was the breakdown of the lenient rule, the strict rule, and the middle test. At pages 27 through 29, I cite all of the jurisdictions that I independently verified were lenient test states or courts. The strict rule, I only found 8 courts that approved the strict rule. And with regard to the totality of circumstances rule, I found about an equal number as the lenient test. So what my research has shown, and which we represent in our briefs, is clearly the strict rule, which the Court of Appeals applied here, is a vast minority rule.
What kind of rule do you want? If you were writing this opinion, what rule would you adopt?
I would adopt the lenient rule.
And that would say what?
That would say, consistent with what all of the other decisions of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals has said, is that the attorney-client privilege belongs to the client, and it is the client who is the holder of the privilege, as defined in both 90503 relating to the attorney-client privilege and 90511 dealing with the attorney-client privilege, who has the right to voluntarily and knowingly relinquish that right.
And when does it have to be invoked? In other words, privilege, that's part of the problem here. In other words, some of the documents were already there, and in the hands of the attorneys? When do you invoke this?
I didn't hear the beginning part, Justice.
When do you invoke that rule?
When do you invoke the rule?
That's correct.
After it has been discovered that privileged materials have been turned over and a request for their return is made. We didn't spend a lot of time in our reply brief talking about the totality of circumstances rule because of the word limitation, but I just would like to make a few points here during the time, and I know I'm running out, but the reason we don't advocate the totality of circumstances rule is because of the uncertainty that is then presented with the attorney-client privilege. You have different courts applying the five criteria to different factors, and the chances that you're going to have different and conflicting outcomes increases when there is such a rule. Moreover, there is certainly an unfairness element to the totality rule to the client, because a lot of the circumstances that the court evaluates in applying the totality of circumstances rule is out of the hands of the client. It's the attorney that turns them over, and that's one of the issues. It's one of the factors. It's the attorney that turns over the amount of documents. It's the attorney who has the precautions in place against such disclosures. And it's the attorney who usually discovers the error and then tries to correct the situation. Those are four of the five factors, and that rule has a certain unfairness to the client, with the result being that the client loses the privilege. I also want to note that the totality of circumstances rule also will present greater litigation in the area of the waiver of the privilege. There's going to be many more arguments, many more evidentiary hearings, many more appeals, and much more litigation, which will sidetrack the actual merits of litigation. And so it's our position that the lenient rule serves best the interests of the client, who are served by the attorney-client privilege, the lawyers, as well as the courts. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Schlicht, and thank you, Mr. Hallowen, for your arguments today on a privilege case in a different setting than we are ordinarily accustomed to hearing on privilege. That ends our hearing on 02-1515, Sampson Children's Trust versus the Gail Sampson 1979 Trust. Thank you very much. Before I call the next case, court will take a short recess so the students who are here may leave and the students who are here to hear the second case may come in. So we are in recess for a few moments.